Hey, this is Jackson Brown, and you're listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senors and senoritas. This is Chris Shiflett, your old pal, Chris Shiflett. As always, the host of Walking the Floor, episode number 198 of Walking the Floor. And I know last week I said that I wasn't going to go back to that every week schedule, but I lied, man, because I did a good interview today with Jackson Brown. I just wanted to get up because he's got an album coming out really soon, and it's timely, man. I hate it when the interviews sit too long, so I just thought, try something new and just blast this out. I haven't even listened back to it, but I don't think I said anything too stupid. But I guess you'll be the judge of that. Anyway, what else going on? I just got some rough mixes from my man Jaren from Cadillac 3 that's producing this new record, this new solo record that I've been working on and chipping away at. And I'm pretty excited. I'm pretty excited at how this stuff is turning out. Some good tunes and great players and I'm really enjoying the production value of it that Mr. Jaren is bringing to the project. Not sure when that's coming out, but hopefully sooner than later. And I've got a couple of other things that I think I'm going to post pretty soon to the streaming services. So I know I'm being very vague, but I don't have details on any of that stuff yet. So coming soon, I promise. New music, it's been a while. Anyway, let's talk about our good buddies at Zounds.com. You know, at Zounds.com, you always get free shipping on every order. There's no exceptions, there's no exclusions. And of course, Zounds has three warehouses strategically located all over the United States to get you your gear faster than anybody else. Like within 2 days or less, generally, is what I'm talking about here. Zounds.com, you know them, you love them. Go check them out. And we shall start the interview now. Oh yeah, it's always a good day on the podcast when you get to hang out and talk with a legend like Jackson Brown, a man who is not only synonymous with Los Angeles and Southern California music, but has literally decades of classic tunes in his catalog, still making great records. He's got one coming out on July 23rd called Downhill From Everywhere. I've listened to it. It's great. I've met him here and there over the years, like at shows and stuff, and just kind of briefly. I wouldn't really exactly say I know him, but I was really struck by just how comfortable he seemed in his own skin, just full Zen master, you know, Southern California elder statesman of the music scene. He was great, and you don't really get that energy a lot from people in this biz, especially people that have been in the biz for a minute. And at some point towards the end, I hit him up to take me surfing at an exclusive surf spot that he has access to, and he said he would, so I'm gonna hold you to that, Jack. Jackson, one of these days. This is Jackson Brown on Walking the Floor.
Don't make mistakes and they don't know the feeling.
Hey, buddy.
Hey, Chris.
Hey, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm good. Look at you, right on time. Yeah. A consummate professional.
It's rare, for me to be on time, but yeah.
Awesome, man. Are you at your studio?
Yeah. I'm not in the actual studio proper. I'm in a kind of writing annex, a kind of room that I used to
play
the area.
Right.
Room. Guitar, incredible. Guitars stacked like cordwood. You know, I mean, they're just built up during the pandemic.
Ooh, yeah. That was one of the things I was going to ask you about, was your epic vintage gear collection, or if you have one. Like, I didn't know if you were one of those vintage gear. You always seem like you're playing like a really beautiful acoustic.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got a bunch of old guitars. It's true. And I like new guitars, too.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some great guitar makers. I mean, the luthier's art has really, really advanced in recent. I mean,
sure.
Of course, there's nothing. It's nothing more amazing than seeing like a really old guitar that's perfectly built and in tune and in great shape, you know. But I mean, a lot of my old guitars, there's been stuff done to them. I mean, sometimes you have to replace, you have to do a neck reset or replace a bridge or something. I had this one guitar that I wanted really bad, and I could see there was a crack in the bridge, but he wasn't going to fix that. You know, it was like he was going to sell it as original, even though he knew that the bridge had to be replaced. So I had to pay the full totally
vintage,
totally original price for it,
yeah.
And then take the bridge off.
I think all my vintage guitars and amps and everything, I think they're all things that are not considered collectible. I think that's the trick to getting getting a good old vintage gear. You get the stuff that's just a little dinged up, a little rough around the edges. You know, like my only really super vintage, like I have a 57 Les Paul that has the original PAFs in it that started its life as a gold top, and somebody for some reason sometime took the gold finish off it. So it's like, you know, it's affordable, but it still sounds amazing. You know,
you get it perfect for you. Now you can
exactly.
I had that with like a Nick Lucas guitar that was somebody had painted black, and then it wasn't, you know, it wasn't going to be out of reach anymore. You know, I mean, it's the color, and I liked the color. It was cool, but no longer collectible.
Is your stuff that you've like, do you have like the guitar, have you held on to your guitars through the years? Like, is your collection stuff that you were acquiring, you know, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, all through?
A lot of them, but yeah, I still have a lot of the guitars that worked for me. I mean, there's some guitars that I don't have that got ruined, you know, one time or another, you know. I thought about it the other day. There's a guitar I had that was kind of my first guitar that I bought that was my guitar. I borrowed my brother's guitar and borrowed a friend's guitar. And I had this great Guild, I think it was a D40. And I wanted to try a pickup in it. And I just wanted to make a pickup and tape it in so I could hear what that would sound like, you know?
Yeah.
Because this is really early times, like 71 or something. And he got excited and cut the face away and installed it in the neck position, and like the face just collapsed. And
oh no.
Now I wish now that because I could probably have fixed that.
Right.
I mean, I wish now, but at the time I was just, I gave it to somebody, but it was junk, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now it'd be like the thing that's sought after, like, dude, you got Jackson's guitar that you cut into, man. Thing's worth extra.
Well, I did there's a couple guitars that I misguidedly put a Floyd Rose on.
What? That's about the last thing I ever expected to come out of your mouth. You do not strike me as a Floyd Rose kind of. Did you go through like an Eddie Van Halen phase there?
Oh, I didn't. It's just my tech thought it would just keep me in tune.
Right.
There'd be less tuning involved. And I did it to three really great guitars.
Wow.
And then later I just thought, what have I done? That's crazy. So now I like restored the bits of the neck that were cut away and put blocking in, and you know, like, and now it's the life of the guitar. They're great guitars, and you know, but I mean, I showed this, it wasn't a super rare guitar. It was not that collectible. And it actually had, there were these three guitars that I had a guy make these. It's when I first got dialed into what I wanted the neck to feel like on a Strat or on a Tele.
Right.
This guy make these necks. And so it wasn't like it was a collectible guitar or anything. You do what you want, right? But I mean, I have a couple, you know, really expensive old guitars, and now I'm, you know, paranoid about traveling with them or something.
Yeah. You got to play them though. You got to play them. Yeah. I'm like, I didn't get to experience touring in the 70s or the 80s for that matter, but my fantasy version of it is like when you first started touring, you could walk into any pawn shop and find like a 59 Les Paul on the wall for like $150. I mean, was did you find those kind of crazy deals back then?
Yeah, but I wasn't looking for electric guitars. I mean, the truth is that I think that I only had two or three guitars. I mean, the guitars that work for me, you know. I only thought just the other day, like, how did this happen? Because I've got so many guitars sitting there. The thing is that it's not a collection. It's all stuff that I've tried to make work, you know. So there's stuff that you buy because you can. You've got the money to. But at some point, I started, you know, pawn shopping, you know, when it was still possible to get really great, find really great stuff. But that kind of went really quickly. I might have been right on the forefront of that wave of like guys that were going out and they're buying everything. And
right. Just make sure you keep your eyes on that Val McCallum when he's at your studio. You don't want to be, if you see him loading something into the trunk of his car, he might be walking off with something. Get away. He's no slouch in the vintage guitar department himself.
No. He's really, we were on tour with the Heartbreakers And there was this trader came out and set up in this sort of tent out in the parking lot. I mean, it wasn't their tent. It was some sort of, you know, guest lounge or something like that. And they'd set up. And so, and we went out there to see what they had. And of course, it was during the Heartbreakers soundtrack. So we were seeing these guitars before them. It was kind
first
of
rude. Dibs.
Well, we, you know, well, he not only did it to, he just bought everything that was. I had a guitar I really liked. It was this beautiful, like 0018 without a mark on it. It was a beautiful, even grain. I was thinking I really liked it. He said, let me see it. And then he decided he would get it. And I thought, I didn't make a big deal about it. I thought, yeah, okay, if you really want that. But if you don't keep that, you know, be sure you sell it to me. He said, okay, all right. Which he didn't, which like about a year later, like he sold, he traded, because he trades stuff really quickly. You know?
I thought you were going to say at the same show, he unloaded it to Mike Campbell or something.
Well, no, as we left that place with guitars in our hand like that, we could see the Heartbreakers coming from the soundcheck. Mike was coming across. And we were leaving with, Val was leaving with a really great, you know, two pickup SG with, you know, with P90s in it. And it was, you know, there was that look of like, oh no, how these, you know, I knew we shouldn't be sound checking. Let's discontinue the sound check, which they did after a while, but not because of that.
Right, right.
Yeah, they just stopped sound checking after a while. Their shit was so bulletproof, you know.
Right. Yeah. They knew what they were doing by that point, I'm sure. I watched you guys on Kimmel the other night and was really struck. I mean, you sounded great, and I love that new single, Cleveland Heart. Your band, you have assembled like the band. What a perfect band where everybody, I mean, for people listening that don't know, Val McCallum, like one of the great guitar players ever, Greg Lease on the pedal steel, who's also a ridiculously good guitar player, and then Elvis Costello's rhythm section. I mean, it's just like the perfect California, the perfect LA band.
Well, that band is sort of, that's actually Val's band when I mean, they're called Jack Shit.
Right. I saw you at a Jack Shit show because I opened for them at the Mint a few years ago. And I remember you were there and you got up and played with them.
Right. I remember that show at the Mint.
Yeah.
So that's they're the band on that song. That's not really my band that I go out with. I do go out with Greg and Val in the band. But we did the Kimmel show. We were going to do it with my band, and but they're the band on the record. And also, I couldn't get my keyboardist, Jeff, who sings the high parts. And we needed that high part. And Davey can sing that really high part, no problem. But actually, I missed clear, and I went, wait a minute, let's just get the guys that are on the record to do it, and then we play together all the time anyway. So
right,
well, we did it that way, and it was fun to do. And they're so good, Pete Thomas.
Come on.
And Davey Farragher. And it was a lot of fun to do. And because everybody's such good friends, it was also fun to do the video, because that can be like really exhausting.
Sure. Now, you guys looked like you were having fun. It looked like a band.
Yeah.
I mean, I was really kind of struck by that because I was listening, you know, getting ready to interview you, and I was listening not only to your new record, which sounds great for people that don't know, it's called Downhill From Everywhere, coming out July 23rd. But, and listening to a bunch of your old tracks too. And I know like it's, you know, you've had a long career and made a lot of records, and I'm assuming there's a lot of different people playing, being your backup band on those records, but there's somehow a real consistency even through your new one, which it's like has that balance of sounding fresh and classic at the same time, you know, but it just sounds like you. How do you kind of accomplish that in the studio?
Well, it's just sort of what the residue of a lot of different searches. I mean, I wind up with the same. I guess I want great solos. You know, I spend more time getting the drums right and the bass drum, like the arrangement right on this record and a half for the last two records than I did in previous years. But also I think I really want the solo to tell the story. I want it, you know, I want, I don't know how to quite answer your question, except that I, in some ways, I've always sort of done the same thing. I used to be really happy with the lyrics were done, and the, you know, I'd forget to make the record. I just like, because I also write in the studio. I'd start songs that aren't really finished. That song, Cleveland Heart, was something that was, it was the first song we tracked for this album, and it was the only song that was really finished when I went in, you know, where the lyrics were finished when I went into the song. So, but the other songs, it's just, they're the record of a search, you know, to try to find what's really going on in the story. And I think all my songs have kind of been the product of that kind of a search. And I don't know, I learned somewhere around my fourth album that stuff would happen in the studio that I didn't know was going to happen. And I'd have to be really kind of fleet of foot to kind of mess with them and even change the words if that's what we required, you know? And then sometimes, yeah, I'm used to, and I also, lots of times I hung on to a take I loved because something happened, you know, some David Lindley played something unbelievable. I knew he would never play again. I thought, I'm keeping this track. Even though later I realized, oh, this track, I should have cut this again and just made everybody try to play the same thing or get back. Thing. So I don't shy away from cutting things, you know, over and over again. And I've got a studio, so it's just like, you know, not that big, not that drastic a thing.
Do you produce this record yourself or do you bring somebody in?
No, I produced it. I've worked with producers only a couple times, but yeah, I produced it. And sometimes I've co-produced with band members. You know, I did a couple records with Scott Thurston co-producing, and one where Kevin McCormick was a co-producer with Scott. But that's really to say that it's the same group of people. And even though I'm saying I produced this record, I work so closely with Greg Lees and Val McKinney. I really take their advice and they really have a say like it's a band. I mean, it's like the kind of band arrangements. And there were a lot of songs that I wrote when Mark Goldenberg was in my band. And I mean, it was really based on the way everybody played. I mean, songs were really like, oh, we can do this because of the way everybody's playing.
Right.
And I'd kind of lace the lyrics up, you know.
Really? So you're going in the studio with sort of like bits of songs and incomplete lyrics and stuff and just working it on the fly.
Sometimes, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I'll have like a verse and a chorus and I'll be singing them through the song and say, let's play this, you know, and then you've heard a verse and a chorus and then I'll start counting out, just calling out whether, okay, take it to that verse. Or let's go to the bridge, you know, and basically everybody gets lost.
Right.
That's where the great shit happens.
Right, right.
Playing together, doing stuff, I go, I'm going to use that, you know. Love when that happens, or like, and some songs only had I didn't want to write a lot of verses, but the way Fritz, my drummer Mauricio Luwak, we call him Fritz, he played it, the length of this and the take that was so great, it was had five verses. I thought, what the fuck am I gonna
You can repeat one, but you can't repeat two of them.
I realized that I could, you know, then it had this like little breakdown in between. And there's this whole thing in the story that happens because of the length of that he played it in. And I thought,
interesting.
Oh, that's really cool. Like, you know, but I'm always trying to get out of writing more words than there should be there, because I have too many to begin with. The stories are too linear. They're too linear. You have to be paying attention. And I think that in a way is antithetical to really great rock and roll. For a great rock and roll, you should hear those lyrics because, you know, they stick to your mind and multiple listenings and stuff. It shouldn't be something you have to like, you know, really pay attention to.
Well, and as a performer, it just means you have to like memorize a whole lot more too. Which when I was younger, it's funny, when I was younger and first really trying to write songs, I thought you had to be clever and change every pre-chorus and that each chorus would have to be a little bit different. And then I realized like, that's not how any of the songs I like are. And it's just so much harder. You're just like creating roadblocks for yourself, you know?
That was something that John Landau said to me one time, and he wasn't producing my record at the time. He just came to see what I was doing. And, I really admire his advice. And at one point he just turned to me and said, you know, the lyrics are changing every time you get to the chorus. You're like changing some fundamental thing you're saying. But the chorus is where everybody gets to take a break. This is right. Where you get to hear that chorus and go back and it's like, huh, you know, and yeah. Then get your verse where you have to pay attention. So you, and he's right, you know. I've written some songs that are really hard to remember, the variations in the chorus. It's like, why would it do that? Why would it change that line, you know?
Yeah. I mean, some of my favorite songs, I mean, I think of Merle Haggard in particular was the master of this, where it's, you know, "Today I Started Loving You Again" has one verse and a chorus, and then it repeats the chorus, and that's it. That's the whole song. It's like one of the best songs ever written.
Yeah.
You know?
That would be a great an assignment to give yourself. You know, Moon River is the same way. Moon River is the same thing twice.
Right.
Verse and this sort of wonderful variation on it, you know, and it's just like, then it repeats it because it's that good.
You know, I'm always curious with folks like you that have made a lot of records and have like a giant catalog of classic songs, you know, how you sort of like game up for putting a record together. I mean, and certainly we live in this time where there's no shortage of things to write about and be inspired by, but you know, how do you sort of, you know, organize your thoughts and get like, okay, it's time to make a record and, you know, get like, how has your sort of songwriting process evolved over the years in that regard?
You know, it's very mysterious to me. What I began to do, I mean, I always, even though I had a studio, I always sang into a little, no, I didn't always have a studio, even before I had a studio, but I wrote on a little cassette player, you know, and it's about the size of a small Bible or something, you know, and matter of fact, we called it the Sony Bible. I gave one to Steve. It was a thing about capturing, being able to just push record and just record a 20-minute thing a little search, you know, and
yeah.
You could go back, especially replay your mistakes or the things that you did once and can't seem to do again. What was that thing? So now that we've got phones and, you know, IDs and you can log these things. I mean, I've got like really hundreds of little snippets of songs and things that I want to turn into things. And sometimes I can go, I just wrote a song recently that I thought, oh, that's where I'll go get that piece from that I like so much. And I put these two things together and they work perfectly. And then, so I'm just sort of like tinkering with things, but the mystery I'm referring to is like how what you're going through in your life or how what you think you're talking about really is lying on top of something else that is what you're really dealing with. And that comes out in spite of the fact that you think you're writing a song about this, if this other thing comes up from it. That's the mysterious part for me. And then when you begin to realize what you're writing about, then I can kind of maybe shape it some more, you know, for that story too, to be, but it's a long process for me. I don't write very quickly. Although on this record, a couple songs got written pretty quickly. And that was like really exciting to me because it's the way I used to write. I lived alone and was like, and had no place to go and had no money and
right. nothing to do but write.
Play guitar and write songs. And I wrote more then, but not that many more. I mean, I was always slow. So, you know, I think that it's a little bit like even when I think I've got a great phrase, something that, you know, that I'm heading for, the rest of it is a search for things that resonate with that phrase or will get me there. Like writing "Late for the Sky" had the last line, you know, before, and you know, I don't say it till the end of the song.
Right. So you got to write the whole thing backwards from there.
Yeah, I just sort of wrote the song heading for that last line. And
right.
But also songs like "Downhill from Everywhere" was a remark made by this oceanographer named Captain Charles Moore, who kind of discovered the great Pacific Gyre, this collection.
Right.
And he discovered it by just, he was motoring across the Pacific back from Hawaii, and he was like in his research vehicle, you know, like boat. And he just realized he was going through all this plastic, and so he began measuring it and stuff. But he said, and he's an activist for dealing with this mess. But he said the ocean is downhill from everywhere. And I thought that's really quite, it's a riddle, you know, kind of like, what is it? If you say downhill from everywhere, I mean, what is it that could be down actually? And it turns out to be really, it's not only just about the ocean collecting all our waste, but being the repository for all of man's, you know, waste, you know? I mean, everything is waste. Everything we've done, not only plastic waste, but it's also, in a way, I mean, there are all these things about the ocean that, that are the carry our folly, our ambitions, our folly. I mean, in a way, it used to be, there used to be the things that separated countries and that you'd have to overcome to get from one place to the next. Right. And the places to dump everything.
Right.
It's just places to dump our shit that are, yeah, that
we'll never have to pay a price for this. Just dump it over there.
Wait till, like, you know, we just, you know, so there's a lot of dumping, overfishing and all this stuff. But I, what I, like, again, I didn't want to write a song like my friend Holly Neer said, you know, people see me coming and they think they're going to hear 900 verses about fuel rods. And I, how do you get out of, like, making people think that they're about to get a lecture? You know, you want to.
But that's really hard. Like, do you struggle with that? Because I find that really challenging, trying to weave politics and current events and the things that are happening that you're, you know, that you, we all have an emotional reaction to, and sometimes it makes you enraged and you want to put that in your song, but exactly like what you're talking about, you don't want it to be a lecture. Like, how do you sort of, how do you approach that?
I think you have to talk about what people already know about, what they really already feel strongly about, or if they hadn't thought about it in a certain way, but at least they're familiar with the subject. I think that, you know, that's the problem with some topics, is that people haven't really been, they're not that acquainted with it. Like when I tried to write a song about Central America, and that most people didn't know what our policy was or what we were doing there.
Right.
About Vietnam, but they didn't know about Central America. And I started reading about Central America because I had been reading books about Vietnam from after the fact, you know.
Right.
War by Anthony Caputo. And then I just sort of segued in this book about El Salvador, or, you know, written by Joan Didion. And I thought, holy shit, it's the same thing. It's the same thing that was going on in Vietnam, but it's happening in El Salvador. And so the question was how to, if nobody knows what you know, now that song is a song that people, they've presently found out all about it because of the Iran-Contra stuff, and it certainly became kind of known what the song was about. But the mistake I made at the time was I thought I had to explain what the song was about when I'd sing it live, and then you really do, then you really sound like a lecturer.
Well, I imagine, like, because somebody like you that has been outspoken throughout your career on various issues and stuff, and like writing songs about Central U.S. foreign policy in Central America, whatever. I imagine you must suffer from the shut up and play thing that happens to anybody, that any artist that has an opinion about anything, really. Because like, even when people more or less agree with you, I feel like a lot of the time they still kind of do the shut up and play thing. They just don't want to hear it from a musician, you know what I mean? It's an interesting thing. It's like, how have you, do you care about that? Has that been like, has that affected you? Have you, like, lost fan? You know, like what's your take on that?
I didn't worry about losing fans so much, but I wanted to learn how to do this without, you know, putting people out, you know?
Right.
Sometimes, you know, they might yell something in the middle of my talk. I mean, I did shut up. And just play.
It worked. Shut up and play. Like, okay, all right.
Just play the song. And what I realized later was that the song,
right.
You can play the song without an introduction. The matter of fact is that way. And people are drawn into it, and people now know a lot about it. And if they hadn't known anything about it then, they would have found out. In fact, they did. That's what happened to that song. But and Downhill from Everywhere, I didn't want that linear, the necessity to follow a linear train of thought. And so all these images are kind of juxtaposed images that are kind of good as bits too, you know?
Right.
Downhill from the prison, downhill from the mall, downhill from the factory farm and the hospital. And what do all things have to do with each other begs right. the question. And so it's, I leave it for everybody to make the connection. What is it that it's the same about all those places? And for that matter, without having to go into it, there is something similar to a prison in a mall. I mean, you're a prisoner of your consumerism, and
sure.
the goods that are made in that are for sale in that mall are made by prisoners. And so all those resonances, you know, are there, and it's better without having, you know, spelled it out.
Without spelling it out. That's interesting. Let people find it on their own. You know, I mean, obviously these last several years have been, I mean, really, for me, the crazy started. I mean, how do you exactly say where it started? It's, people think of it as the Trump years. I think things really went off the rails during the Obama years in a lot of ways, with just the polarization and sort of like, if I'm a Republican, everything is the Democrats' fault. And if I'm a Democrat, every single thing is the Republicans' fault, which to me, it's total nonsense. But that's so deeply permeated, like mainstream consensus wisdom nowadays. And there was a quote in your bio that like, I just don't hear a lot of people out there saying things like this, but it really struck a chord with me, where you said, but the person who sees enemies everywhere is also a human being. And what I sing has to be true for that person too, because I'm talking about them, or I'm not talking about them, I'm talking to them. And I just don't hear a lot of people saying things like that. And I had this argument so often through the Trump years with my friends, like, look, you may see, you turn on MSNBC or CNN and you see some Trump supporters saying something crazy and it's offensive and it makes you upset, but you have to understand it as those folks are victims of this whole thing too. Yeah. They're our countrymen too. And we need a little more like empathy for people.
Yeah, completely.
And also, you know, an acknowledgement that our side is about 50% responsible for fucking everything up. So like, we got to get real about that.
I want to write a song called Just About Half the People. Because win any election, you have to have just about half the people. You don't even have to have half.
Right.
You can riff on that too. You could just say just about half the people are out of their mind, or just about half the people, you know. And how is that supposed to work? And it only works if you agree that there's going to be this contest between the ideas. And at some point, the winner will be whoever has, you know, it's just like a tug of war. You only have to pull the other side like a foot over right. the line, your side. And then you still have your opinions and they have theirs. You win because of this artificial, well, it's a decision. It's a covenant, really. It's like whoever gets the most votes wins, except that we're not doing that anymore. It's, it's the between the Electoral College, the popular vote, all that stuff.
So the
problem is you're still left with half the people thinking one approach is the way to go and the other half thinking the other way is to go.
Yeah.
The whole point is to win the contest. The whole point is to win the contest, not to solve the problem.
Right.
To the people who I disagree with, that to those people, they're fine as long as they win the contest.
Right.
Things go on the way they've been. To me, there's the way things are, let's say about global warming, or let's say about racial justice, or let's say about the health of the ocean. So to me, those things can't go on and on without being addressed. And so it's not just that we want to win. And the problem is we're in electoral politics where we have to have that contest. But even now, they're creating restrictions to everybody voting. So they're making it
right.
so they can vote. And that's part of the problem, is that they don't really feel that some people are entitled to vote. They shouldn't be allowed to vote.
Sure. Well, the last thing they want is a really engaged, informed electorate.
Right.
You know,
that's right. And they've
it
been
works much better for elites when you don't have that.
That's right. That's right. And I have this, you know, blind faith in the idea that if you give people the information to make an informed decision, that they'll make the right decision. But then I've been proven not to be the case over and over again, where you can give the people information, they still make a decision that's really informed by their own interests, and not necessarily their interests, their understanding of who's here and who the system serves is very, it's limited by their own you know, self-interest and a short-sightedness, you know. And that's true of people. That's just a human frailty.
Well, it's interesting, you know, I was just watching that Reagan documentary series on Showtime. If you haven't watched it, it's really good. Robert Shear's in there. They have some good folks in there. I'm always struck by, you know, having been in the whatever music business for as long as I have, I'm always struck by how people, the general public, smart people, well-educated people, don't get how much politics at that level is showbiz.
Yeah.
And you really see it in that Reagan documentary, but it's true of really kind of everybody.
Yeah, I thought when Reagan became president, well, I just didn't think it would happen. I'm completely off in my own world where science matters and, you know, I mean, but I mean, there was the precedent to all that was Adlai Stevenson, who was an intellectual and who couldn't win an election because people just thought of him as this sort of egghead, or he's like, he just knew stuff that they didn't know. They don't, in so many ways, Reagan was a paid spokesman for corporate.
Literally. I mean, yeah. that is in fact, exact. I didn't realize that whole side of it.
Yeah. General Electric. He was the spokesman for General Electric Corporation, which makes so many different products, including nuclear reactors, of course, but weapons, guidance systems and all this stuff, and irons and toasters. And, you know, he was like he's a salesman, you know. And
yeah.
The lovable kind of, this American voice that he sounded so authentic. But he's also the host of the 20 Mule Team Borax, I forget the name of the show, but it was like, he was the host of these, he was the guy that came on and did the pitch in the 50s. He was doing the pitch for this.
It wasn't like GE Theater or something like that?
Theater, but also this other one was Boraxo. It was like,
ah, okay.
He was like it was like old Western tales, and he'd have a cowboy hat and he'd have a few words about their sponsor. And then you'd see these kind of great grainy black and white movies for TV, like TV adventures that were, half an hour long. They weren't movies. They were like, you know, TV episodes, episodic TV show. And he was, once again, he was a salesman, and he wasn't a particularly distinguished actor. He might've been in a couple of hit movies, but he, you know, the thing that really cracks me up is that, you know, he was originally slated to be in Casablanca.
Wait, what? They skipped that part in there. Wow. That would have been a very different movie.
We'll always have Casablanca. he somehow fell out of the mix, or somehow they couldn't get him. He wasn't available, and they had to get Humphrey Bogart instead.
Yeah, they had to settle for Humphrey Bogart. Well, his son said something really funny in it that, because, you know, his son is like, you know, more left leaning. Yeah. And he said that he would get in like sort of ideological arguments, or their arguments on policy or whatever. And that it would always get to a point with his dad where his dad would just throw his hands up and say, well, all I know is, you know, whatever, and then repeat his sort of like GE talking points. Yeah. He'd be like, but I just explained it to you. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. As soon as we had an actor for a president, then way the veil was ripped away. I thought, oh, I see why this works. I see why it works, because the president has always been on script. He's been on a script. And it doesn't matter if you have someone who's very good on his feet and who can improvise, like Clinton or Obama, who have a huge amount of information at their fingertips or on the tip of their tongue. They can just cite all this stuff. Or whether you have someone like Reagan, who, when the teleprompter broke down when he was addressing the European Union, famously said, well, we'll have to wait for, you know, they literally waited. He couldn't read the speech. I mean, it was a speech, obviously. He didn't want to read it from a piece of paper.
Sure.
And to now, I see exactly why. I mean, having, for a long time, I wouldn't use a teleprompter because I was so outraged. this is the tool of these, you know, these kind of scripted talking heads, and I thought I won't. And even now, I don't like. But now, I mean, I had to learn how to use one, because if you don't learn how to do it, then your eyes are sort of pinned. Yeah. What you're saying, and it's a skill. And I appreciate It's called acting.
Yeah, it's the cost of having written too many damn songs, right?
Yeah. Well, somebody just asked me if I was going to use the teleprompter on these new songs, and I thought, well, first I'm going to spend the next couple of weeks trying to sing them, you know, six times in a row without fucking up, and I haven't done it. I mean, like, especially, but I have to inhabit these songs, or they have to take up residence in me. They have to be something I know by heart. And yeah. I heard a great interview with Anthony Hopkins, and it was on this great podcast called Awards Chatter, which I really recommend. Every one of these interviews is so good. This guy, I mean, he's saying, you think he's going to talk about the secrets of acting? He said, the only thing really matters is memorization. You just have to know your lines.
Mm.
And if you know your lines, then you can say them.
Right. Well, I think with singing songs, it seems like it's, you always sing better when you don't have to think about the words, when it's just coming out of you, you know?
Yeah. My favorite, when I started doing shows that were completely unadorned, where I play completely by myself. I mean, the joke was at one point I was going to do a solo acoustic tour, and everybody said, oh, great. Who's going to play with you? It played out well. And that's actually what I said initially. They said, no, we want you to play by yourself. It was this thing that my agent in England said, no, people want to hear you stand there. But that turned out to be like a real turning point for me, because what I found is that to sing these songs in whatever order, it didn't matter. Without, matter of fact, in no order, it was really good. Spontaneously, you just have the song, and I began to really feel the songs. I began to hear them the same way as if I was hearing them for the first time. Some part of it was just the listener.
Right.
Right, and that was because I knew the songs well enough to, I just simply would play it. And you know, as a player, you're trying to make sure you play the certain part well, or remember to do that thing, because that makes it feel better to have that little beat in it or something that you're doing. So you're working on the journeyman part of being able to execute the song well enough. Meanwhile, the song somehow you know it by heart, and then you hear the thing like. As if you're the person listening. That was really refreshing for me, because that almost never happens with a band, because there's so many other things to take your attention. And I had a friend who I said I was going to do a show up in her area. She said, oh, are you going to play with your band, or are you going to do this? This is going to be one of your shows by yourself. And I said, oh, well, with a band. She said, oh, well, I'll skip this one. And I went, oh. So you prefer me by myself? She said, oh, yeah. And then later, this was a joke between us, you know. And she's a smart person. She's a gallerist. I dug her take on most things, you know. But it was that people felt more – I don't think it's just this, but I think the people felt more like they were alone with the song, and there wasn't – that especially I wasn't interacting with the other guys on stage.
Right.
I wasn't busy with this listening to Val play or like turning,
right.
Having something to do with that. I was just there with the song. She preferred that. And every time I see her, sometimes she'll come to these shows, even though I'm not playing alone. Or sometimes, at one point, I said, I'll tell you what, I'll do this. I'll do the first half of the show just by myself. And then I'll do the second half with the band. She said, okay, let's see, you know. So on that occasion, my band, for the first time, ever heard me play these songs by myself, because they don't come to a solo show.
Right.
They're not,
right.
Show up for that.
Yeah.
They were waiting to go on, and they listened to me, and they went, oh, that actually, I prefer that solo version of Looking East to what we do with you. That's like, that's
interesting.
So interesting. Yeah, they suddenly went, oh, we got to get more of that.
Yeah.
When we play with you. And they stopped trying to achieve so much as a band of their, in terms of their own, you know, playing and their own execution of the song, and tried and sort of lined up with whether the song is being served.
Right. Right. yeah, that's like maturity as a player right there. There's, I feel like when you're just playing by yourself, that's like the most exposed you can be as a performer, especially for a schmo like me that grew up playing really loud, heavily distorted, rah, you know, crazy noisy stuff. Like when I go up and just play an acoustic set, that's like as scary as it can
yeah.
be.
Yeah.
But it's great. Well, hey, what's that?
I was going to say, I've written songs that I thought were these big ass rocking songs that were, you know, then gradually like the parts get stripped away. I mean, Kev Mo came in to sing on one song and he said, well, let me hear it without that part. I would take that. Pretty soon it was just me and the chords. And he said, okay, I can play to that, you know.
Right.
So much of what happens in the glory of making a big sounding thing, you know, is somehow can obscure the song.
Yeah, well, it's a funny thing, especially with making rock records. Like a lot of times if you keep layering guitars and you're like, oh, it's getting bigger, but you realize it's just getting smaller somehow.
Yeah, yeah.
Squishier and less defined, you know? Hey, here's a complete left turn, but when's the last time you watched Fast Times at Ridgemont High?
Well, it's been a while, I guess.
You know, for people of my age, that is like an era defining movie that like, you know, that might have been the first time I was exposed to your music, you know, as a kid, because, you know, obviously Somebody's Baby was a massive hit. I mean, did you have any sense? Was that just like an extra song you had laying around, or did you write it for it? And did you have any sense at the time that it was going to be this massive hit?
Yeah, no, I didn't know it'd be a hit, but it was a song that was. I'd written with Danny Korchmar, and it was a hard song to write. I didn't think there was much to it, and I wasn't going to put on my record, because I, in those days especially, I made albums that I thought I even knew where everything went in the sequence. I thought I was writing, you know, and I was hung up, and in the end, because in the end, I wind up with a sequence that worked, but I wasn't going to put that on the record, and I should have. Especially after it became a hit, and I had the right to. And my former record company president, David Geffen, called up and said, like, you're going to put that on your record, right? I said, no, I wasn't going to do that. He said, well, you should. And of course, I should have, but I didn't. And I'd written this song with Danny, and it happened to be the first song, the first thing we ever did when I bought my first 2-inch tape machine and a console, and we were in a loft downtown, and we hooked everything up and said, well, what do you want to play? And we said, well, let's play that thing we've been working on. And it sounded great, right? So later, Cameron Crowe asked for the song, a song for the movie. I thought, well, that'd be the perfect one. And I sort of went looking for it and found that it the one that was really good was like Take One.
Really?
One on my Studer, which now is in Jonathan Wilson's studio, but it's basically a song that it's so simple. It was hard to write a second verse. It was really just about making something that sounded good and felt good. And I think that's a big lesson, because all that stuff kind of tended to take, in a way, all that got bred out of my song, especially in that era. I mean, as hard as I worked to make songs compact and like that, like the song, okay, for people who know my songs, it would be that it would have gone on the record, same record with Lawyers in Love, and I don't know if Bill, I used to know that all these records. I mean, it was that period where I was trying to make singles, trying to make stuff that was very influenced by a lot of new wave and punk. And just trying to get something that was really very immediate. So that song's not punky at all, but it's like, it is kind of economical, you know? And no, I didn't think it would be a hit. And I also didn't know that. Now I think it's like the song I'll be sure and play when I go out now, because it's actually, to see the audience when and maybe it's just the power of a popular song.
Yeah.
So that when I first started seeing girls get up and dance to that song in the middle of my, and it just got, I got the memo. It's like, oh, this, they feel good. They feel good listening to the song. It's about them. It's about them being shining, you know, and being, you know, it's as simple as that. And it was so much more fundamental than most of the stuff I was trying to write about.
It was just like hits you in the gut immediately. Yeah, I think because of the way it's used in the movie too, it's got that, it's like, you know, it's not a downer song. It's not a minor key song, but there's a melancholy to it. There's that little bit of heartache in there, you know?
Is there? Wow, interesting. Because even like the organ player is my longtime friend Doug Haywood, was playing organ in that lineup, and he's a really interesting musician. He's came up with a lot of chewy parts all during my records. But like he used to be my bass player, and he was that really that high harmony that gave a kind of earnestness to songs like Late for the Sky or on that record, you know. So here on this, you know, somebody's baby, that little kind of whistle while you work kind of little part, which nobody wants to play. I mean, nobody will play it that way anymore because, I mean, it's just so much better to play something slinkier.
Right, right.
Funkier. So that the guy who plays organ for me now is, loves playing that song, but he's not going to do that kind of Seven Dwarves kind of. But even that is so. Made the song kind of happy. There's something about seeing, and this same thing happens to me again and again. You see a beautiful girl or woman, a female like in full sail walking down the street, and you just stop. You know, you just gotta like everything stops, and you go, oh, wow, that's, you know, and I know that's right. No,
I know that's right.
So, yeah. And I even some of these moments when you see somebody beautiful, I can think of three very vividly. One about, you know, I said this might be the most beautiful girl I've ever seen, you know, and she was just walking past one of my favorite restaurants in Santa Barbara, and I remember her now. I remember her today. So I didn't speak to her, and I just didn't. Another time when I saw a girl walking around by my studio, and she's so startlingly beautiful, and I looked up and there was another guy that was ogling her too. Another guy. We just smiled, this big smile, like, right?
Wow. Right.
Wow. Makes your day, really, you know. And then there was another, I just recently in an elevator, and I thought, and later I think about it, I think, this may be one of the most beautiful women I will ever be, you know, 5 feet away from, you know.
Yeah.
Congratulate myself that I didn't say anything inappropriate, anything lame, anything like. She wound up asking me about my jacket. This jacket, as a matter of fact.
Oh, really?
I told her where it was, but she was like, I wanted, even now I want to know where she is. It was in Beverly Hills. She's probably an actress, or she's probably a, you know, she's just a gorgeous black woman who was, I don't know, just so perfectly, you know, just nature really, you know.
If my wife is listening to this podcast, I want you to know, honey, that's exactly how I feel every time you walk into the room. Just want to make that clear. Clear.
Okay. I got to tell you, I wrote this song on this Haiti record. It's called Love is Love. And there's this verse, there's this line in the song that says, well, you know, Ménage Moi, which means my girl, you know, in Haitian Creole. Ménage Moi is the finest girl who ever walked this island. Even when, especially when she's walking away. And so there had to be this, we were doing a video for this song. So it would have to be a shot. And Haiti's filled with incredibly beautiful women. And, you know, the physiology of Africans is just so pronounced. It's just so great. We thought we're making this video, but we're going to actually let the Haitian director, we have to let these guys choose the whoever's going to be in the shot. We can't be these white guys that are ogling Haitian bodies and like the decider. And so anyway, so at one point, the guy that was helping, who actually helped write that song and was developing this we were shooting this video. I saw this couple, and they were, and I saw them from a distance. I said, well, those are the people that we should shoot for that scene. And he went over there and talked to them, and you know, we didn't have to cast anybody, anything. It was just this really beautiful, and they were beautiful together, you know?
Right.
And he said, yeah, but it might not be the girl with the most magnificent ass. We might not have gotten that out of it. And I said, well, I don't know. When we see it, you know, I mean, it doesn't matter really, because, here's what I think. It's really, it's not that it's the most perfectly sculpted, most beautiful ass in the world. It's that it's her ass. Like, that's the thing about the butt. It's not the world, but it's that it's your butt.
Yeah, I'm gonna write that one down. I can use that later. Hey, dude, I've taken up enough of your time today, and you've been amazing. I have one last thing, not even so much a question, but just a statement, that I am ready to go surf the ranch with you anytime you want. You just let me know. I'll go get my wetsuit and my board, and I'll meet you there.
I would be happy to host you at the ranch. Yeah.
Yes. I actually, you know, I grew up in Santa Barbara, and I had never surfed. I still have never actually surfed the ranch. I surfed Bixby maybe 6 months ago or something for the first time ever. And it was like, and I didn't even get on the beach or anything. I just, you know, went up there on my friend's fishing boat and got some waves. And it was like stepping back into the, you know, it was like 1850 or something. It was just amazing.
Primordial California. Like,
yeah.
Happy to have you come, you know, meet you up there, and have, you know, you can join me up there sometime. I'm trying to make up my mind whether I'm going to go there tomorrow, go for the weekend. But of course, it's more crowded now than it used to be, because a lot of people went there during the pandemic.
So yes.
It's like a concentration of people. But I think that'll probably go back to people just, you know, it's really, I'm sort of torn about it, because on one hand, it's because it's got its owned, it's private, and it's in it, and there are all these restrictions to how much anybody can build up there. And
right.
Can afford to have a second house that they, or like a bunch of acreage that they can't do anything with.
Right.
And so it's ultra, it's, you know, it's not that everybody up there is rich, but they also have this really this ecology point of view.
Yeah.
But also the fact that it's not accessible except by boat. Like, you went to Bixby, and you could have gone to any spot at the ranch and surfed.
Right.
Ranch. And we try to like keep the localism in check. I mean, there are people up there that can be really traditionally have been jerked to people that boated in.
I actually had a kind of a funny encounter that morning, and I was up there with a buddy of mine and his son and three of their friends. So we, you know, admittedly, we're a bit of an Insta crowd. You know, and we paddled out at, I don't remember which one it was, Coho or Perco's or what, I forget what the name was, but you know, one of those breaks first thing in the morning, there were like literally like two guys out there. And I get it. I'm not going to get in anybody's way. I know the rules, you know, I'm not going to do that. And one of the guys, and I was kind of sitting inside from him, one of the guys caught a wave and went by. And a little time passes by, and you know how surfing is, and just, we were all kind of spread out, and I was sitting there by myself, and it's like super tranquil, and it's beautiful, and it's first thing in the morning, and all of a sudden I realize that the dude is as close to me as this mic.
Yeah.
He's right there. And I turn and cut, whoa! And he doesn't say hello, he just looks at me, and then just kind of paddles on. I was like, good morning, I get the message, sir.
Well, who owns Bixby and who owns Kirkwood? I mean, it's like, right. In a way, who owns that? Those waves are public. They're not. I disagree with the idea that those waves belong to anybody. And the localism is always, you know, I'm not competitive, but I don't surf well enough to be competitive. And that, like, at the ranch, there are breaks that are for those guys. And then there are breaks for family people, where everybody's welcome. And people
yeah.
Generous. Oh, you take, oh, this is you.
Right.
This is,
right.
You know, or who will, you know, or who will, like, you know, in with a mischievous, you know, like, you know, who will snake you mischievously and say, hey,
right.
Here I, you know, but the spirit is completely different. And to me, that's as different as the way you look at the world or society. There are people that are out to get theirs and really, you know, very, and people who are out to make sure everybody gets theirs.
Yeah. Well, surfing's a funny thing. I go into any break, especially if it's relatively remote, that I'm not, or, you know, that I don't surf or have maybe never surfed. I just go in there assuming nobody wants me to be there and I act accordingly. You know what I mean? I just try to wait my turn and, you know, figure out who's kind of running things and be respectful and
whatever. Well, I've paddled in to get some wax for somebody that didn't have wax. It came from a boat, you know?
Yeah.
I just try to be hospitable. At the same time, one time I took off in front of somebody. I didn't see them. Little didn't see him, and he was from a boat. And he got really in my, kind of issued a warning. And I said, "Look, I just didn't see you."
Yeah.
He started to go on about it. I said, "Hey, dude. I didn't see you. I'll be careful. You know, I won't. I won't do that again. Just so you know, it's not like a. But you know, that's the thing is if there's Here's what I think. It's like guys that come to a remote break have taken more trouble to get there than the people that live there. They've made more of a commitment and gone to more trouble. That's what I think. That to me, that's the kind of coin of the realm there. They're more committed. They're more. Think about what it was like when you were young. You'd do anything to get to the beach if you were 14.
Right. Yeah.
Anybody driving there, like, or go. Or you hear about a break, or you're paying attention because you want to be there. That's the ticket right there. It's like, I don't think. If you want to surf in Big Sur, you go in a boat. If you want to surf Channel Islands, you go in a boat. You want to surf the ranch, you have to go in a boat. And I don't think that it's like all the efforts to open the ranch up to the multitudes are going to screw up a highly sensitive ecological environment and
well that's the bummer about it is my sort of gut is to be like, you know, I'm a progressive and on the side of the people and all that, but at the same time, you know, it's if you let a bunch of people down there, it's going to get fucked up, you know, it's going to get abused.
It's like the Nosferatu syndrome, you know. Nosferatu doesn't, I mean, he loves virginal beauty. He's not thinking if I bite this girl in the neck, I'm going to, you know, violate her. I'm going to corrupt her. She's going to become a vampire too. He just loves beauty and he's just like, can't help himself. He's Nosferatu. And that's the way the metaphor for all of humanity. We all really love these pristine places. But one of my favorite quotes, Joe Walsh knows the people that owned Santa Cruz Island. And for many years, no one could go there, and actually still nobody can go there, but he there was a film about the island. He said, and I wish I could do Joe Walsh because some of my friends who can, it's hilarious. But he said, if you love this place, for God's sakes, don't come here.
Right. Totally. Yeah. Well, it's like those stickers. Who made those stickers? It said like surfing sucks. Don't try it or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. Well, dude, thank you so much, man. I've really enjoyed talking to you. This has been fantastic.
Really great to talk to you, and thanks for inviting me. And yeah, if you want to surf the ranch, and if there's a time when would you be waiting for a big swell, or you would just want to go when whatever's going on there?
Whenever, yeah. You know, the bigger the better, I suppose. But you know, it doesn't have to be all the time. I've been stranded. You see, kids, that's how you invite yourself to somebody else's surf break. That was Jackson Brown on Walking the Floor. New album is called Downhill from Everywhere. It's out July 23rd. Go get it. Wasn't he great? He was fantastic. I don't know if I'm going to see you in a week or two or three. Things are like kind of busy, you know? Things are getting busy. But we'll be back whenever we're back, and we'll see you then. So take care of yourself until we do. Adios, amigos! They just plug in and shine.